Jeff were bored to death and thought, what we gonna do about that? Then a flash of inspiration shot through the brains and they both yelled, let's make a podcast. Talking to musicians, asking lots of questions and wearing lots of goofy hats. I don't know about the hat thing, for your benefit, picture them in goofy hats. Don't sit around and wonder what the F. I now introduce The Hour with Matt and Jeff.
All right, welcome to the Radio Hour, your home for enlightening discussions with artists where we attempt to go deep into the craft of what they do to find out how they do it. And perhaps most importantly, how are they doing when it comes to surviving in this crazy music industry business? I'm Matt Wardlaw, and my musical brother Jeff Giles is here with me as well. Jeff, how are you doing, good sir?
It is always a red letter day on my calendar when I get to talk to you.
I tell
Matt,
you,
how are you?
I'm doing good. I got out the red permanent marker on my end and just scribbled all over the calendar with just excitement and glee.
And your wife lets you get away with that still?
She absolutely did. That's kind of weird. Like, it's weird saying wife at this point. I think this is the first podcast that we've done since the wife thing happened. And the good news is that the wife thing the wife is thing. Remarkably similar to the fiance thing. She still won't let me eat Taco Bell ever, but other than that, her disposition's pretty good. I think it's going to work.
As long as she doesn't catch you calling her the wife thing, I think
exactly.
You're good.
Exactly. Well, we have to give kudos to our friend Joshua Jesty, who composed our newly revamped theme song. He has his own podcast called I Made You a Mix CD, Why Don't You Fall in Love with Me? And perhaps we can talk to him another time and explain to him why that concept doesn't work. but you can find that podcast conveniently at imadeyouamixcd.com, and you can also subscribe to that podcast via the website or on iTunes. And if you don't do that, he'll be sad, and he'll probably start emailing us. And it's been good not getting those emails from Josh, so please email him. Well, our guest today has a great story that has carried her all of the way to talking with us, which could be a momentary low light in her career, but we're going to work through that together. She has a new album called High Heels and Sneakers, and she's going to join us to talk about that and a whole lot more. Please welcome Tess Henley. Tess, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being brave enough to talk to us.
Well, it is a highlight, I will say, talking with you two. And congratulations, too, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah.
Now, see, Jeff, I think this is going to be good. I told you that Tess was going to be nice.
You've got a good feeling about this now?
I have a great feeling. Well, let's start out talking about your beginnings. I was very interested in kind of your upbringing because you first began dabbling in music at age 3, working with the Suzuki Method, which is something I also worked with growing up. But you did the Suzuki Method for piano, which for those who aren't familiar with it involves learning to play music by ear. Can you talk a little bit about that and where things kind of went from that point as far as how your development kind of went?
Yeah, my brother and sister and I all took classical Suzuki piano lessons growing up, and it was a huge part of my life. Lessons every week, recitals every month, and practicing every morning before school, elementary school. And so it's a very, there's a lot of focus, and, you know, it's, you have to be on top of things to kind of keep up with it. And you kind of go through the books, different books, and you learn songs, memorize them, play them at the recitals, and then you move on to the next book. And I did that all the way through to my senior year of high school. But I kind of got into playing and singing in about, I've been singing forever because my mom was in a band, but I kind of started playing and singing at the same time and trying that out in elementary school as well. And I think my first performance doing that was second grade at the school talent show. And then it just kind of became a natural progression, you know, playing and singing, and then writing my own music my senior year of high school. It's my first song. And then I recorded my first album my freshman and sophomore year of college.
Well, jumping back real quick to the Suzuki side of things, how quickly did you buy into that? Were you interested in all that? I mean, because I guess my experience was that, like, I've seen it go both ways, that, like, you know, if you're kind of, I guess, naturally inclined to, you know, want to get into music, it's kind of an easy sell. But at the same time, you know, if you're not, you know, obviously you have the kids that kind of go, I don't know if I want to do this. And it can be a little bit of a harder sell.
Yeah. I mean, music wasn't the only thing going on in my life. I was really into sports. And so, if my mom hadn't been cracking the whip and making me practice every morning before school, if I didn't practice in the morning, I had to come home after school and practice before I could do anything else. And if she hadn't done that, I probably wouldn't be playing, because it's just, you know, you hit plateaus when you're learning something, especially an instrument. And as a kid, it's just like, who wants to do that? I wouldn't say I'm like this musical virtuoso and it just comes so easily. It's not like that for me. So, it's something I had to work at, and I'm really grateful that my mom kind of, kept on me about it.
Yeah. The goal, I guess, is not really to be a virtuoso, right? I read an earlier interview where you talked about how when you know how to play an instrument, it can be a friend to you later on. I thought that was a really neat way of describing that knowledge base that you built thanks to all that whip cracking.
Yeah. And that was my mom who wanted us to have this lifelong friend, because she, being in a band, she sings, but she doesn't play an instrument, and she knows, you know, how helpful that can be, being able to accompany yourself, and she wanted us to have that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I guess, just as far as you started, like, I guess, your development into, like, more of a traditional artist, did you get into, like, you know, learning how to read music and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what, as far as my learning growing up, that's where I started, was reading sheet music and music. That's all I knew, you know. And then with the Suzuki method, you do scales and working on finger dexterity and that kind of stuff. But as far as, I think for me, learning to read was first, and then learning by ear was kind of, I did that on, you know, on my free time. And then that's something I got into later, which I wish I would have done that even earlier. Because I think there are advantages to both and being able to do both. But that's actually where what I started doing, was reading music.
So at what point, how does this transition happen where you go from playing and singing and writing to being a college student who starts pursuing music as a career?
I think it kind of just, like everything else, you know, it was a natural progression, and
it seems like a pretty
music,
big leap.
It really, I mean, yeah, it was, I don't know. I mean, music's always been around in my family, and my brother is also a singer-songwriter, and my dad loves music. So it wasn't something that was pushed on us to become, you know, artists. My dad is a very business-minded person, so he, being a musician was not really on his list, you know. But I think when I first, when I finished my first album at the University of Washington, I was, I started out in business, and then I decided that wasn't going to work for me. And I went to architecture, which I really love design. And I think if I hadn't done music, I probably would have liked to do that. But, you know, I kind of, that was my, the point at which I decided to fully pursue music. I decided, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And I decided, because architecture is very competitive and demanding. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to do communications. It's a very general major. If this music thing doesn't work out, I, you know, I have something like that to fall back on. But at that point, I had pretty much decided. I had the album. I think I might have been working on my EP at the time. I was playing gigs around Seattle and kind of growing a local following. And at that point, it was kind of, I had figured it out, although I was still figuring out how I was going to make it happen. And then I graduated, and that's when I could really fully pursue music. That's kind of when I went all in on the music thing.
I want to just go back to the college part of your story for a couple of seconds, because one mm-hmm. of the things that we talk about from time to time on this show is the fact that often the people who experience success in the arts are people who come from a background that give them the time and the opportunity to do something like go to school, and you know, where they're not kind of forced into just trying to focus on make a living. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, school was always, getting my degree was always really important to me. And I guess at the time I wasn't, you know, I was kind of just going along. I was a college student. I wasn't thinking too far ahead into the future. Right. But I knew deep down that I would be doing music and I would figure it out.
I want to ask how you got to the point where you decided all of a sudden, okay, hey, I'm going to make a record. Like, I mean, that, I don't know how, I mean, I guess for people making music today, certainly all of it has gotten easier as far as how you do it. But I just don't know how daunting that would seem from your perspective, when you look at, okay, I'm going to make an album. Like, you know, how much did you know about the process, as far as, you know, making an album, you know, where do you do it? Do I want to go to a studio? All that kind of stuff. Like, what was that like for you?
Well, my first album was very, you know, I had no idea what I was doing, and I was lucky enough to have the full support of my family. And I found a producer who I still work with to this day. I think he's just super talented, and he plays, keys and organ, and he has a really great mind, and, we worked well together, and, I actually didn't even have any sort of business plan or release for my first album, and it did well. I mean, I actually, a lot of things that have happened for me have come from that first album, but there wasn't really much thought. It was just like, okay, I need to start somewhere, and I have these songs, and let's just see what happens when I put a CD together and send it out to people. But this last album, the High Heels and Sneakers album, that was a whole nother project, because, you know, I've recorded in Seattle, which is where I'm from. But this was, this would have been in Philadelphia. So then that threw in another factor of having to travel and coordinate everything across the country. And, you know, then you're down to time, you know, time and money. And this time I did have a really well laid out business plan. And so this was my biggest project. And it can get overwhelming, you know, because it is a lot of work, and especially when you're doing it on your own and you're funding everything and you are, you know, there, everyone knows how quickly money can go, when you're making music and promoting it. And if you're funding that yourself, it's just, that alone can be overwhelming. And then you have the whole, you know, recording the album is one thing, and then promoting the album afterward is a whole nother thing. So I'd spent months recording the album, and that was an amazing experience. But it was a lot of work, and I was traveling back and forth from Seattle to Philadelphia. And I had done pre-production in Seattle and kind of had everything laid out before I went out to record. Finally finished the album, and then I started thinking, okay, now what do I do? You know, I kind of had this plan, but then it's just, man, gosh, there's so much involved. And, so it is overwhelming at times, but I'm very blessed to have a family and a team that helps and supports, and is there for those overwhelming times.
It's good to hear you talk about the learning curve behind all this, because mm-hmm. I know it can be painful for a lot of artists. And I think a number of artists don't even know that they really need to do all this stuff. You know, not that it's mm-hmm. not just that it's daunting to try and figure it out, but that they're still hoping that somebody else will come along and do it for them. Mm-hmm. But the new record, I think, it sounds A&R'd, if that makes any sense. I know mm-hmm. that I'm probably a little bit older than you, and
or a lot.
A&R execs are, or a lot. And A&R executives are not really a thing anymore. But, you know, it sounds like mm-hmm. somebody was in the studio with you saying, you know, these are our goals for the next record, and now go write me a single. And it's mm-hmm. It's impressive that it sounds that way, because it was you. You know, and I wonder how Tess, the label exec, turns to Tess, the artist, and says those things. You know, how do you compartmentalize the process?
Yeah. Well, like I said, my brother is also really involved in my career, and he would fly out with me, and he's kind of the guy to. You have to be willing to take criticism, and you know, I do have my own vision and direction, but I do want people to give me honest opinions. I don't want, you know, just because they're my family, I don't want them to say, yeah, that's great, you know. But my brother and everybody in my family is always there for an honest opinion, but my brother especially, he's very picky and detail oriented. And he kind of went through the process with me and gave me his opinion. And we kind of went back and forth on what we thought, you know, he'd say, okay, I think, you know, you have a really great album here, but I think you're kind of missing this kind of song, or, you know, this particular song is great, but you don't have it needs some more energy, or whatever the case. He was always kind of there to give his opinion, and I really do listen to him most of the time.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because I think I've seen that, you know, kind of relationship between, you know, artist and, you know, producer, or, you know, mm-hmm. person that has creative input, however you want to term it, that there are definitely certain things where sometimes, like, the artist, you know, really, you know, sticks to their guns over a certain point. You know, I recall, you know, watching some friends of mine that are in a heavy metal band, you know, talk mm-hmm. to their longtime producer and, you know, just flat out at some point say that, you know, look, you know, when you're not working with us, you're a pop producer. So, you know, understand that, like, you know, what you're suggesting right now, in this particular case, that doesn't work for us. We're a metal band. So, you know, every person has kind of like their trademarks. And I guess I'm just curious if there's anything like that where you really kind of like stuck to your guns and said, you know, no, this is, you know, this is how this needs to be.
Yeah, well, I'm really all about collaboration. I don't like to be the only one. I just think that it's better when people are giving, you know, their own input. But there are certain things that I wanted to make sure of, you know, and I guess one of them would be like the last song on the album is called I'd Do Anything, and it's, I wrote it about my cousin, and I wanted to make sure that that was the last song on the album, because it had a it was really important to me. And you know, everyone has their opinion on the order of the songs and what flows the best, but that was something that I had to make sure that would be the last song. So there are little things like that. And I think that it's always great to listen to other people's advice. But if you start kind of listening to everybody, you can kind of lose yourself or start to question your own, you know, artistic ability, or if what you know or if what you think is right, you know. So I think there's a fine line between that.
Yeah, and I think it can be hard, you know, learning, you know, when to kind of like pick your battles and when to yield to that advice that, you know, might be good advice. So I think it is kind of hard finding that balance, I would think.
Yeah. It's, I mean, for me in particular, my family is very outspoken when it comes to their advice. And sometimes my mom has a different opinion than my dad, and they have a different opinion from my brother. And it's at that point, it's just like, you know, I think I'm just going to do what I thought I was going to do at the beginning. but yeah. And the producer I worked with, Kari Mateen, he, is extremely talented, and he kind of brought in his own flavor, and he was a big reason why that album sounds the way it does. So
let's talk for a minute about soul music and how you found your way into the genre. I think Matt and I read different things about your background. I read that the radio was banned in your house when you were a kid, and he read that wasn't maybe necessarily the case. But either way, I'd like to know what were kind of your gateways into that music, and what drew you to it, you know, at a young age.
Well, my parents, especially my mom, being in a band. Was playing kind of fun dance music like classic rock and roll, Motown, and my dad was into a lot of different, like, Rolling Stones, Beatles, Eric Clapton, Sade, and so there was a wide variety of music playing in the house. And it's not that they necessarily banned us from listening to the radio, but they just didn't want us listening to, you know, they weren't fans of the type of music that was playing on the radio, you know, the profanity or whatever the case. And so they just wanted us to listen to their music, which I was totally fine with at the time, you know. And I really enjoy all the music that they have introduced me to, but I was really drawn towards the Motown and the soul music. And I remember listening to the Jackson 5 and Donny Hathaway and Stevie Wonder, and Aretha Franklin, and I really took to Stevie Wonder. Especially when I got into songwriting, he's still one of my biggest inspirations. And then I kind of in junior high, I kind of got into neo soul and R&B, and people like India Arie, and Brian McKnight and Lauryn Hill. And so I've kind of always just gravitated towards soul music. Not necessarily soul, but anything that is done with emotion and honesty, and even gospel music. I love listening to that, and so that's kind of, I don't know, just something that I always listened to growing up, and along with all the different types of music that my parents played, you know. Then they'd play like the funk side of things, like Tower of Power, and they would even take us out to shows. I remember going to see Tower of Power and George Benson. Nice. And people that I didn't really know, you know, at the time. But I'm glad that they took us, because now I really appreciate the knowledge. Where it started.
Yeah, I think you run into a lot of that as a kid, if you're lucky enough to have parents, because certainly my parents did the same thing, sharing music with you, because, like, you know, if they do take you to shows, it's like you don't appreciate at the time, like, mm-hmm. how much that means. But later on, like, I mean, for me, my parents, you know, took me to see Peter, Paul, Mary. My parents took me to see Dave Brubeck, among others. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and, like, particularly somebody like Brubeck, I really started to just realize what a giant that guy was in the field. And mm-hmm. certainly I think I know Jeff will identify with this, but you mentioned Stevie Wonder. And, like, I know mm-hmm. the first time that I heard Stevie Wonder, I mean, my mind was blown, you know. And then when you see, when you find out that he's blind and all that, I mean, it's just like, I mean, just crazy, just the mm-hmm. amount of talent that just is present in every inch of that guy's body.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's a musical genius across the board. And I mean, everyone in our family loves him. So, I have yet to see him in concert. He's on my list.
Yeah. Yeah, he's on my list as well.
Maybe that's something. Yeah.
Well, we wanted to ask you, I mean, as you're no doubt aware, the Pacific Northwest is not exactly known for being a hotbed of soul music, and we've spoken with other artists who have made a name for themselves by going against the grain of the local scene. And it seems like while it mm-hmm. can help, you know, you set yourself apart as an artist, it can also be a little bit lonely in terms of fitting into a community. So what's your experience been like with that?
Well, I totally understand that, and I wouldn't say that soul music is the thing here in Seattle, but I do feel like there is a soul scene, or soul artists coming out of Seattle that are doing well. I think it just takes people some time to actually catch on to it. And you have artists who have done well outside of Seattle, and then they come back, and then everyone's just, you know, all over them. But I think especially with if it's not kind of the indie rock or folk, or, you know, I think if it's not in that vein, it's going to take something more to kind of get them to jump on board. So I kind of feel at times that I'm going against the grain, and it is difficult, you know, especially when I do have a lot of great support here in Seattle, but sometimes it's hard to get the media on, you know, into it, because they're just into another type of thing. And that's kind of why I went to Philadelphia to record, because I knew that that's, you know, it's very historically known for its own kind of soul music, and you kind of have to go where they want to hear you. And I know that Seattle will always be my home, and I know I have a support system here, but I think, you know, there's a time when you kind of need to get out of the box a little and not worry too much about the hometown support if it's not just gonna happen, you know.
It's good that you mentioned Philadelphia again, because mm-hmm. that was where we wanted to take the conversation next. You know, it's
perfect.
funny how long it takes how long it takes people to kind of change the narrative that's attached mm-hmm. to a city culturally. You know, the music that everybody thinks of when they think of Seattle is all mm-hmm. 20, 25 years old. And when you say Philadelphia, a lot of people think of Philly soul, which is no longer really a thing. But mm-hmm. like you say, there's still that community, that support there. And mm-hmm. the next thing we wanted to talk about was your decision to work with Dice Raw on this record, mm-hmm. because obviously it affected the decisions that you made.
Yeah. Well, I'd kind of been reaching out for a while to different producers around the country. I just kind of started with producers of some of my favorite albums. And I even planned a trip to New York to meet with a couple. And I came back to Seattle feeling like, you know, maybe I'm just not sure if I've found the right fit. And then when I thought that I was kind of at the end of my search, I didn't know where else to look. I somehow came across an article about the Roots and the studio, which was owned by Larry Gold, who's this longtime legendary string arranger. And I was reading the article and I came across James Poyser, who has produced a lot of albums that I love, including Adele's album and Lauryn Hill and a bunch of other really, really talented artists. And I came across his business partner's name. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I can reach out to him. And I'd been talking to a lot of producers at this point, and I knew that my budget wasn't, you know, anywhere near what James Poyser would take. But I figured, you know, I might as well reach out, see if he knows anybody. And so I sent him an email, and the next day we were on the phone kind of talking about the project and what I was looking for. And he said, okay, well, let me, I have somebody in mind, and why don't we kind of get on the phone and talk about everything. And so that was when he introduced me to Dice. And I decided to go out and do a couple demos over there just to kind of feel things out. And so I did that, did a couple songs over there. And I just, you know, everything was smooth. I just loved the team that Dice put together and the musicians he brought in. And it just felt like, you know, This is right. So that's when I decided to kind of go forward with that. And I think a few months later, I flew out to start recording the album.
Once you got into things, how long was your writing process for the record? Because, I mean, this record, as much as it sounds like a step forward for you, the songs mm-hmm. definitely are in the neighborhood with your work on previous records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was kind of a library of songs I'd had for the last, I guess, couple of years. Some of them were older than others, and then some of them I had, you know, just written a month and a half before, you know, before the demos were recorded. but I went over to Philadelphia with 20 songs to record, and then we were going to narrow it down to 14. So I went out with a bunch of different songs to choose from, and then we kind of just picked the best of those. But it had been a couple years of writing.
So none of that took place in the studio? You came in with everything that ended up on the record?
Yes.
Okay. The one thing that I want to say about this record is that I want to thank you for using real sounds on it. You know, that's such a refreshing change of pace, especially in this genre. I mean, even artists who call themselves neo soul or whatever, often the production is so bright and so mechanized, and this sounds like, you know, you've got such a big voice, and this record leaves it plenty of room, and it's real nice.
Thank you. Yeah, that the live instrumentation was, I mean, when I did the demos, obviously everything was just tracked live in the studio, but I hadn't thought too much, like, is this, you know, I didn't realize that we would be doing everything live, and that was really cool for me to watch, and that was where Kari Mateen came in, because he kind of was the reason why it came out sounding like that, and I really loved the, you know, I like how it's raw. It's not, you know, perfect, but even just percussion, and like, I remember he would go in with like a glass bottle and record some percussion part. And then on Daydreaming, which was the first single off of the album, he had this like Tibetan prayer bowl in his studio and a nail file just kind of sitting around. And he just picked it up and just started playing with it. And he's like, you know, let's track something with this. So that was really cool to see. And, you know, coming up with those kind of percussive things in the studio with him, that was really, really cool.
I think that's some of the most, I mean, from the outside, that seems like some of the most fun stuff about making a record is, like, you know, using those found sounds to, like, create songs, you know, but out of, like, unconventional objects.
Yeah. Yeah, and even just, you know, I mean, those are the unexpected moments that you love when you're recording, and then getting like a group of people in the room to do the claps, or it was a lot of fun.
Moving into wrapping up, you know, what's ahead for you as far as you know, getting out and promoting this record? Like, how much are you going to do as far as, you know, playing shows? I mean, you know, obviously you're talking to us. Really, what's the plan for things coming up?
I am playing in New York at the end of the month at Rockwood Music Hall.
Cool.
And then I'm working on setting something up for LA in September. And then I have a short European tour in December, which will be a lot of fun. But I guess the plan is just to get out on the road and kind of fill in the spaces, you know, And talk to more cool people like you guys.
Is there how easy is that? Is there a version of what you're doing that you can take out in some sort of stripped down form to, like, you know, go out and hit cities besides like New York and Los Angeles?
Yeah, I mean, I've played kind of the whole. I can do solo stuff, and I sometimes bring like a loop pedal. And I've played with my brother, and we kind of accompany each other, or like the New York show I'm playing with, Kari is going to accompany me on percussion.
Cool.
But the European thing will be a five piece band.
Yeah. And
so,
I, I wanted to ask about that because that's really interesting. How are you pulling that off?
That's a good question. I'm still trying to figure that out, but it's kind of one of those things that, you know, it needs to happen right now. And I'll just have to figure it out. But kind of, I'll obviously be funding it myself unless I can find some sort of sponsorship. Or, you know, I might play with a band in the UK. That's another option to save some money. But that's all another project as an indie artist that I'll have to figure out, as, you know, as we develop this tour a little more.
I'm guessing that obviously you're seeing enough signs of European following that make it possible for you to rationalize and really prioritize getting it done.
Yeah, I think, you know, besides here in the States, I think the UK, France, and actually South Africa is another market, one of the top markets for me. But definitely UK would be the second behind here in the States. So it's it will be a good thing, I think. And figuring out how to get those people out to the shows something I'll have to figure out how to promote it. And I know they're there. It's just how do you get them out?
Well, wrapping up, what else do you want folks to know that we haven't covered here?
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess if they haven't listened to the album, I'd love for them to take a listen on iTunes or Amazon if they want to see anything else, videos, or know what I'm up to. Any social page or YouTube or my website, tesshenley.com, has pretty much everything you need to know.
There are some great videos on YouTube. I would recommend the Street Sessions. As kind of irrefutable proof that what you're doing, you're actually doing, and not, it isn't being funneled through a computer or anything like that.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I'll go ahead and wrap things up real quick and just tell folks that, so the new album's called High Heels and Sneakers. And as Tess just happened to mention, TessHenley.com is probably your most reliable destination to find everything and all things Tess Henley at a glance, and that'll probably connect you with all the social aspects. And beyond that, if you do what we do and use Google or your preferred search engine and type in Tess Henley, that will work wonders as well if TessHenley.com is for some reason too complicated for you. But thank you a lot, Tess. This was so much fun.
Thank you. I'm glad we could do this. It was really nice talking with you guys.
Well, cool. We'll look forward to talking to you again somewhere down the line here.
All right.